Is it really possible to apply a knowledge of Austrian economics directly, without any translation or transition tools, to the customer value proposition? Today we talk to a very successful financial services professional who weaves Austrian business cycle theory and monetary theory directly into the design of portfolios for his clients.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. We are constant in our project to build a bridge from Austrian economic theory to advantaged entrepreneurial application in the establishment and growth of real-world businesses. Sometimes people tell me that that bridge can feel like it's a bit indirect. For example, we talk about Austrian capital theory that teaches entrepreneurs to value assets based on their capacity to generate cash flows by facilitating a customer value experience. That in turn requires an understanding of subjective value and the value learning process. And then the entrepreneur must institute and continuously exercise dynamic flexibility in the allocation of resources in response to customer changes. That requires an agile approach to organization, finance, capital, and processes. So Austrian economics takes you from capital theory to agile, but it takes a few steps. It's far less complex, of course, than the consulting industry strategy maps and blueprints and comprehensive transformation circles and tribe maps and agile cell development, but it still takes a few steps. Sometimes the path is more direct. We recently talked with John Chisholm about an opportunity matrix with customer needs on one axis and the entrepreneur's strengths on the other axis, and in each cell where these axes intersect lies a customer need that the entrepreneur is well qualified to solve uniquely. That's pretty direct. When knowledge of Austrian theory is represented in one of those cells that intersects with a meaningful customer need, there's an even more immediate and direct opportunity. Today's guest is a brilliant financial services entrepreneur who is operating a growing business at precisely that intersection. The customer need is to feel secure in the choice, design, and structure of an investment portfolio. That need is highly developed today in this era of money printing, credit expansion, high equity prices, low interest rates, and increased government intervention in economies worldwide, and the expanding regulation of business. And what are the future threats to business dynamism posed by politicians like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, or Emmanuel Macron and Recep Erdogan and Abenomics in Japan, and the entire bureaucratic machinery of the European Union? How should these variables be programmed into portfolio design? Chris Casey has a unique value proposition for customers. He starts from an understanding of Austrian business cycle theory and Austrian monetary theory. He establishes this foundation as the place to start for a selected set of customers for whom he can personalize a portfolio design. Chris may share some of his techniques today, or he may not. We'll see. They may be too secret. But we'll hear an example of the direct application of Austrian theory to customer business in a very effective recipe. Hi, Chris. Welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Hi, Hunter. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about today, Chris. We really appreciate you joining us. You're an investment advisor, you're an entrepreneur, a very successful one. You founded your own successful financial advisory firm. You're a noted speaker, a writer, a philanthropist, and you're also an expert in Austrian economic theory. And you apply that knowledge when you're managing investment portfolios and you're advising clients. So that's a lot to talk about. I'm not sure the order in which we'll tackle them, Chris, but I thought maybe we'd start thinking about how you learned
Austrian economic theory and how you apply it in business, because that's what we're all about at Economics for Entrepreneurs. So how did you develop your expertise in Austrian economics?
Sure. And by the way, thanks for the really nice introduction. I hope my mom's listening, because that's some of the nicest things someone's ever said. But well, it was during college, but it was not because of college. And I guess I've always had an interest in economics. I mean, I remember back in high school, going to the library and getting a book by Galbraith, which was complete gibberish. Except then I interpreted it as gibberish. Now I know it's gibberish. But I found the Austrian School of Economics really by a confluence of a couple events during my college experience. So for some reason, I received the book Economics on Trial by Mark Skousen, which is basically a critique of economic textbooks, Economics 101, taught in a college setting. And I think at the same time, I discovered Doug Casey's newsletter, which I think then was called Crisis Investing. And with Mark Skousen's book, I remember reading it from cover to cover and just realizing everything I've just spent like 3 years or so at that point in time learning was just wrong. And I was taken aback at how concise and how logical the Austrian arguments were. At that time, it didn't take long for me to find the Mises Institute. And ever since then, it's been mainly reading Mises Institute publications, attending events. And by the way, everything under the sun for Austrian economics, I believe, is published for free in PDF form at the Institute. So it's a great resource.
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot to read. You never feel as though you're ever going to get finished. But you combine that knowledge, Chris, with deep financial knowledge. You're a CFA, and I'm not in your profession, but I know that's a very onerous certification. It's like getting another degree. So you invested in that set of knowledge as well as Austrian economics knowledge. So where did your interest in finance come from?
Sure, and I do agree that the CFA designation really is kind of a premier and elite designation. It's kind of the gold standard in the industry, which now that I say that, I guess that means something in particular to Austrians, right? The gold standard. But you probably spent, or at least I spent, 300 hours studying for the last at least two tests. So I strongly encourage anyone like seeking an advisor to make that a factor in your decision making, or anyone going into finance, really consider taking the CFA test as soon as possible. But my interest in finance really stemmed from reading Doug Casey's newsletter that I referred to before. And so there I had observed with firsthand experience someone viewing the financial markets from an Austrian perspective. It was really eye-opening. And it was just the practical application of Austrian theory, which I definitely liked.
So I've been thinking of you running these two paths in parallel, financial knowledge and economic knowledge. It was through Doug Casey that they became intertwined in your mind. Is that right?
I'd agree with that. I mean, economics and finance are very distinct, right? They're very complementary, however. And knowing one in no way means you know the other, as you can see by talking to any mainstream wealth manager or any mainstream economist, for sure. So it was kind of a parallel path that happened at about the same time.
So let's stay with your origin story just a little bit more. I read from your bio that out of college you joined a national firm to practice a financial advisory career. You're an entrepreneur now. You started your own firm. So did you always have that concept of combining Austrian economics and finance, and were you able to do that at the national firm or not?
No, I had this idea pretty much right out of college. The more I read various financial newsletters which were out there, which catered to an Austrian or at least an Austrian-esque crowd, the more I learned that there is a demand for this. And I realized that there's no one actually fulfilling it from a wealth management standpoint. But back then, it probably would never have worked, or at least the business idea would not have worked without a massive startup cost, because it's not really since the advent of the internet and social media that we're able to connect with potential clients because they're all geographically dispersed. And yet it's a pretty small niche group of people that believe in this. And then I look back and I think, on top of that, I don't know if the marketplace is really ready for a wealth management firm that specializes in Austrian economics, because I really think the Ron Paul campaigns and definitely also the financial crises in 2001 and 2008 did a lot to educate investors, or at least it opened them up to hearing an alternative opinion and probably forced them to go ahead and look for some answers out there. So it's probably best that we didn't launch this right away. And on top of that, you know, I spent a good deal of my career, you know, learning about marketing financial services businesses. So this is, it worked out that it was later on rather than sooner.
So we often try to advise entrepreneurs that it's a good thing sometimes to start work at a major corporation or a national firm before you become an entrepreneur, because there's a lot to learn and there's a maturing process and so on. You learn a lot of techniques. So that sounds like that was your experience. Is that right?
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, good. So you fulfill one of the standards that Per Bylund always sets for us, which is identify a narrow group of people with unmet needs and then serve them better than anybody else has served them. So you've definitely done that. So tell us specifically, Chris, you say in your materials that I've read online that an understanding of Austrian economics is vitally important, those are your words, to designing portfolios. So give us the case for that.
Well, I think it's primarily because the two biggest risk factors to anyone's portfolio, what you would call macroeconomic risks or beta risks, as a financial person would say, are really inflation and recessions. Recession being that they destroy, you know, any kind of financial bubbles that are out there. And so it's not just about risk mitigation, it's also return maximization in that sense. I've always thought that the best way to make money in the financial markets is through a contrarian investing concept, right? You're investing when things are cheap, and they're cheap because other investors don't share your opinion. So what better lends itself to contrarian investing than Austrian economics? So it allows you to judge the true impact of various events and actions, like Federal Reserve actions, apart from the marketplace and react accordingly. So give you an example. So mainstream wealth management firms currently probably unconcerned about a recession, but we are. You know, from a long-term perspective, they're not concerned about inflation, but we are. And I think people need to start thinking about positioning themselves now.
Well, I know there's something called the Austrian business cycle theory that helps people understand how inflation and recession occur based on activities of the Federal Reserve and monetary policy. Do you describe Austrian business cycle theory to people who are investing with you? Do they need to know that? Do you have a simple way of communicating it?
Well, some of them, of course, are familiar with it just from believing Austrian economics to begin with, but not all of our clients are like that. So we certainly do discuss it at length. And I think it's intuitive for people to understand whether or not they've ever read any economics whatsoever, or whether or not they're familiar with Austrian economics. I mean, the way we look at it is that the interest rates are a price, just like any other price there in the economy. Well, I shouldn't say just like any other price there. They're actually a key price. And when you distort that price, you've distorted every decision that people make about investing. Because when you look at any kind of discounted cash flow analysis, it all relates to the interest rate and what your cash flow projections are. And when you've artificially lowered it, all of a sudden things that seemed really like they were going to work on paper, and maybe they started working once you started, will suddenly not work when interest rates rise. And so I think intuitively people understand the concept of malinvestments, and they understand that from a business perspective, which leads them to, I think, an investing perspective as well.
And so the second part of that sentence that I read out was about designing portfolio. So if people accept your observations about risk of inflation and recession and the contrarian approach, how do you actually design a portfolio? I walk in to your office, I've got enough investable funds that I'm a qualifying client. How do you go about the design process of a portfolio?
Well, it's definitely customized to everybody. You know, depending, everyone has different risk tolerances, liquidity needs, return demands, et cetera. So it is definitely customized, but in general, it's a top-down and a bottom-up approach. And by that, I mean, you can't just simply invest and have the correct thesis, right? You can't just understand that there's maybe you should be in emerging market equities right now. It's one thing to understand the basic thesis and get that right, but you also have to get right the actual security that you're using, the actual investment you're making. And so that's the bottom-up part. So the top-down part, you know, we use our economic viewpoints, where we see the economy headed in the next 6 to 18 months. We create kind of an overall allocation between asset classes, so that's between stocks, you know, bonds, real estate, commodities, et cetera. And we use a bottom-up approach to really find the best securities to use in each of those securities, each of those categories.
And you said somewhere in your materials, I think, that it's an entrepreneurial approach. You're entrepreneurial about identifying those individual investments, the bottom-up part. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and by entrepreneurial in this sense, I think we mean an open mind to consider investments that mainstream wealth managers would not consider. And I'll give you a couple examples. I mean, just in general, mainstream wealth managers do not like private investments, even if the economics and the financial returns and the risk mitigation warrant consideration. They just generally don't like that. But on top of that, there's other things that they reject, which I think make no sense because they can't gauge them on a relative basis to an index or a benchmark out there. And a good example of that would be farmland. So farmland is a huge industry, right? It's, if you look at the value of farmland relative to other real estate asset classes alone, it's a huge component. And yet there's no benchmark of farmland securities out there. And so for someone to invest in farmland with a mainstream wealth manager, it's very unlikely because they can't assess the return. So instead of looking at it from an absolute return perspective, they solely are focused on the relative return to some type of benchmark or index. So I think that's a very short-sighted mentality. And if you have that mentality with farmland, which has been around for, you know, tens of thousands of years, what's your mentality when it comes to something like cannabis or cryptocurrencies, mm-hmm. let alone precious metals? I mean, that's why they're very reluctant to consider different investment themes like that.
Yep. If there's no index, we don't want to be in it, right?
Exactly.
So you design the portfolio, you presumably have some kind of return estimate. Those are all objective kinds of things. They're numbers. We always like to talk about subjective value in Austrian economics, and that the value takes place in the domain of the customer, their subjectively chosen goals and the means they choose to end them. So do you think about their subjective goals? You say it's a customized approach, but are you looking at some of their emotional and subjective needs as well?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's really key. Now in our business, I mean, there's a lot of businesses where you have objective measurements, right? And we certainly have that in the wealth management space, right? You can look at your statement and you can see a return, right? That's a very objective measurement. But ultimately that objective measurement is part of a subjective experience. It's how the client feels, not just from the return, but it's what's seen and not seen, right? It's what they could have made less. It's the fact that their risk has been minimized. Really, it's the experience, I think, of sleeping better at night, knowing that if certain events unfold within the world, the financial world, that they're going to be okay. And so it's really a subjective experience. It's not just how they're feeling about it, but how it's going to help them achieve subjective goals, right? It's the retirement they want to hit at a certain point in time. It's taking care of kids to a certain extent. So yes, ultimately it is a very subjective experience.
Yeah. Confidence and a feeling of safety and those kinds of things enter into your relationships, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Yep. We were just talking recently with Mark Packard about experienced value, and the consumer experiences value entirely in their own mind. That's the value experience. And then they look back on it and assess it. And I would think in your business, sometimes the the numerical assessment could be less than they had anticipated, perhaps, but the emotional assessment was, boy, I came through that okay. I'm safe. I did well. I met my goals.
Or, Hunter, the numerical return could be far higher than they expected. You're correct, though. Ultimately, it's a subjective experience, and that's a big part of it, returns, but there's other factors at work.
Yeah. Now, I didn't mean to decry your results. I'm just trying to...
I was just joking.
Yeah, just nail the subjective experience. So you said, and I think you say in your materials as well, that the investment advisory business taken as a whole might lack some of the objectivity and independence that you've talked about. I know I've heard the expression talking your book. So you've got some funds that you actually own and operate, and you recommend those to your clients. And that's pretty common, I guess, in your industry. But those are the big firms. Often you're an independent. Are you able to compete with those? We're always trying to understand the competitive nature of entrepreneurs versus the behemoths. How do you do?
Well, I think and we have done well. In fact, most of our clients, I'd say that especially those that have a kind of an Austrian mentality, have come from somewhat of large, you know, what I would call the white-shoed Wall Street firms. And the biggest thing is that their advisors, it's not that their advisors at those firms disagreed with their viewpoint. It's that their advisors didn't even understand their viewpoint. So when they're coming to them and saying, I'm concerned about a recession, the advisor's sitting there and looking at economic data, the unemployment rate, interest rates, what have you, say, I don't see it. I don't know what you're concerned about. They don't understand their rationale and their reasoning. And on top of that, Wall Street in general is a very much a sales culture, right? They're far more concerned about losing clients than they are about losing clients' money. And that's why you hear all these phrases they use, like you can't time the markets. You know, no one can time the market. They use phrases like you always have to be fully invested. I mean, these are very sales culture type comments, in my opinion, that aren't reflecting their clients' best interest. So we do compete against them, even though it's, you know, the 800-pound gorilla versus a much smaller firm. But I think it makes a lot of sense.
One of the discussions we had with Per Byland recently was about scale, and he said that really scale is a choice on the part of the entrepreneur. Your real focus is on value and making sure that your customer receives value, experiences value, and you choose how many customers to have. You choose your scale. What's your attitude to that, Chris? How have you chosen your own scale?
Well, I think it does make a lot of sense. I mean, when we do strategic planning, we talk about leveraging our resources, right? Let's do what we do best and leave other things to other firms or advisors. And I'll give you an example. You know, the wealth management industry is just ripe for some type of disruption because they all sound and act very, very similar. And because of that, because they all have the same viewpoint and they position clients in a very similar manner, they start competing with each other in ways that are not their core competencies. So now all of a sudden your wealth manager is giving you tax advice, right? They're trying to do all this kind of planning. That's how they're competing. Well, that underscores the fact that they don't have anything original to say on the investment side.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about scale, yeah, we've made an effort to plan and grow by leveraging what we do best and using other people. So I'll give you an example. There's a lot of firms that have internal reporting teams. And so you could have a 40-person firm, and 10 of them are just dedicated to creating quarterly reports for clients, right? And, you know, in our mind, there's no reason we should be doing that. There's plenty of firms out there that create reporting. They automatically pull the data from your custodians, and they present it in real time, and they have great quarterly data that they can present. So in our mind, there's no reason we should be doing that. So we do try to, we don't want to grow too large from a personnel standpoint. Another reason for that is that in our experience, especially in a professional services firm, at some point politics takes over, right? If you're If you have 100 people in professional services firms, there's a lot of politics involved. And that's just something we want to avoid, no matter how big we get. And so when you think back, I can't remember the name of the chapter, something like why the worst rise to the top or something. Yeah. Remember in the Road to Serfdom with Hayek? Serfdom.
Right.
Yeah, that's not just applicable to government. That's perfectly applicable to large corporations. Absolutely.
Yeah. So one of your choices of scale is to avoid the risk of politics.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I've used that word risk. You've used it a couple of times. I want to switch to thinking about your role as an entrepreneur as opposed to a financial advisor, Chris. You said that an entrepreneur is not one who assumes risk, which is, I think, the standard wording in the textbook, but one that understands risk. Can you explain that for us, please?
Yeah, that may seem like a nuanced distinction, but I think it's important. Because anyone can assume a risk, right? Any business owner can undertake any type of initiative. Well, any economic actor, right? Any person, any household can do anything that entails risk. And in fact, everything to some degree involves some risk. Investors, you know, assume risk. But an entrepreneur, someone that's starting a business, should at least understand risk, right? They should understand what risks are acceptable, what risks are not. You know, what's the likelihood of certain risks that are out there? How do you mitigate risks? How do you circumvent them? So contingency plans is a very dynamic attitude in dealing with the growth of a business. And again, it seems like a small distinction, but I do think it's important.
No, actually, it's very important. And it's cutting edge today, too. We're just finally realizing, in my opinion, that as you say, business planning and trying to predict the future with a plan is not the way to go. What you need to be is reactive and adaptive and constantly changing as the marketplace changes. So that's uncertain, I think, is the word the economists use, but it's what the entrepreneur needs to dive into. In fact, do you differentiate between risk and uncertainty in that? In that description of the entrepreneur?
I think we do. And I know you guys have done a great job of discussing this, you know, the various distinction, whether it's night and the nuances of Mises is applied to that, et cetera.
Yeah.
I mean, to us, risk obviously exists because of uncertainty, but uncertainty does not necessarily create risk. And in many ways, it probably creates opportunity. Let me just give you kind of a real world example that we went through within the last year. So we acted as a strategic advisor to the founder of a company that was launching a litigation finance business. So they basically were lending money to litigators or their clients. And one of the ideas we had was lending money to divorce litigants. So a lot of times, and I've seen this with people I know, that you can have someone going through a divorce and that spouse may have no idea about what assets are owned. They may have no access to any kind of liquid assets. And so they're really at a disadvantage, right? They can't press their case. They can't even find out, get to a point where they know what exists on the marital balance sheet. And yes, there's mechanisms where you could petition to get fees and all this stuff at various states. But in general, they're at a severe disadvantage. And so we came up with this idea. It was at least one of the ideas we would lend to, would be to lend to people in that predicament. And I know there's a market for it. We talked to several prominent divorce attorneys, and I thought this was brilliant in particular because I thought, this is great. The divorce attorneys will act as our salespeople, right? They're on the front lines. They'll find the customers for us. On top of that, they'll vet them for us. And it's because it's to their competitive advantage to pitch this, right? They can accept clients that they otherwise would not have. And we pitched this to a number of divorce attorneys, and what happened? Within 6 months, we heard nothing. No one took us up on it. So we had to go back to the marketplace and figure out, okay, what areas do people need or are willing at least to accept of the loans, that they need loans to either prosecute their case or just to grow a litigation practice.
What did you find out?
Well, we found our original thesis was clearly wrong, right? No one was taking us up on it. We brought it to additional people, still no one took us up on it. So we found a really nice niche because of that, of lending to litigation firms that have needs for to grow their practices, you know, mainly class action, plaintiff attorneys, et cetera. And they would lend, they would borrow and pledge against the borrowings, you know, their portfolio. It wasn't any individual case, but it was a large portfolio, their whole book of business.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I remember the famous case of Frank McCourt, who was the owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers, and I think he needed to get through his divorce before he could liquidate that asset, which he did, and he borrowed heavily against it, as I recall. And he went through that process, but maybe he was an exception to the rule. And
yeah, I'm sure some hedge fund was very happy to lend him some money.
Yeah, yeah, I remember it.
Let me interject here briefly to say, as we listen to Chris and admire his personal style, that there are many individual attributes that you can leverage as an entrepreneur. How's your grit and tenacity? Are you utilizing your highest empathy skills? Do you think about time preference in the best way? Our self-assessment tool helps you think about these things, and it's free at e4epod.com/self. That's e4epod.com/self. It could be your entry point to the community of Austrian entrepreneurs.
So sticking with your entrepreneurial experience, Chris, did you feel uncertain when you launched your business, or did you launch with great confidence? What was that feeling of, the first day like, or the planning for the first day?
Sure. Well, we launched Windrock, I'm guessing around 7 years ago. And so, you know, now we're a well-established firm, but at the time, yeah, certainly there was uncertainty. Of course, I remember day one in the office and setting up just the office in general and thinking, man, I'm really thirsty. It'd be great if we hit some water in here. And then I was like, well, how do we do that? Who do you call for that? So there's a lot of uncertainty when you start your own business. But you have to do it with great confidence. I don't think anyone goes into anything expecting failure, but you have to go in with confidence, and yet you have to be realistic, right? You have to, we've worked with a number of businesses over the years, and it's easy to see which ones fail. I always say in real estate, if the key to real estate is location, 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 the key to any operating business is people, people, people. We've seen it time and time again. It's the people ultimately define whether or not that business will be successful.
Yeah, especially in the professional services business, as you say. Did you have clients that you could count on from day one, or did you go out with a blank sheet and recruit clients?
We had a handful of clients. I mean, just a small portion of the number of clients we have now, but which was great. But ultimately, all that does is extend, you know, the runway. It doesn't actually guarantee anything, and certainly did not in our case.
There are a couple of theories about entrepreneurs. One, that entrepreneurship is a process. You start with a need and you identify a solution to that need and you bring it to market, and it's a step-by-step process. The other is much more personal. It's about personal attributes. Who am I? What am I good at? What are my resources? Can you differentiate between those two for yourself? Which of those do you fit into?
Well, probably a lot of people say both. And mm-hmm. I'd certainly say that's the case in my situation, but I could probably make a distinction between them. So I would say a self-assessment allows you to determine capabilities, or maybe better said, kind of business parameters. So I know that I could work, you know, in a number of different ways in the financial services space. You know I could work probably a large number of other industries, but I can't start a biopharmaceutical firm, right? I don't know anything about that. On the other hand, the identification of customer dissatisfaction is what presents the opportunity, right? So if you could draw like a Venn diagram of those two situations, that's really where you're going to find, and to the extent you find a great overlap, the greater the overlap, the greater success I think you're going to have.
Yeah, that's good advice. I think make them as overlapping as you possibly can. So we talk about time as well in Austrian economics, Chris. Two questions about that. Did you give yourself a certain amount of time to succeed? And the second part of that question is, how do you think about that time in the future? How do you think about growth and what you'll do with your successful firm in a successful future?
Yeah, well, as far as do we give ourselves a certain amount of time to succeed? I never thought about it like that. But that's not to say that I think that it's not a bad idea to have a certain amount of time, because I could see how that could make someone more disciplined. I know someone that makes, let's just call it chocolate, right? They make chocolate out of their house and they sell it at, you know, various farmers markets, and they sell it at, for specialty events like weddings, etc. And as far as I can tell, that person really hasn't grown that business over the years. But I bet if she had in her mind, if I don't do X number of sales by the end of this year, I'm going to either fold up shop, I'm going to do something different, whether it's a great website, whether it's, you know, different sales channels, who knows? I guarantee she would be a success today, a great success. So I do think that makes a lot of sense. As far as our business, how we look at the future, I'm excited about it. So far, over 7 years, we've got great clients. I think we've got great partners. And I think we have a tremendous opportunity, because just like I said before, this may not have worked 30 years ago. I think it's even going to work better 5 years from now, when we do have another downturn, when people really realize the advantages of Austrian economics, what's really driving these financial markets.
Yeah, there's a lot of learning going to come to us in the next few years, I'm sure. So keeping your entrepreneur hat on, Chris, one of our ambitions at Economics for Entrepreneurs is to help entrepreneurs succeed. We're trying to do it with knowledge and understanding of the entrepreneurial process and some of the principles of economics that we've talked about today. But we might want to expand into other ways to help entrepreneurs who are starting new businesses, or they've got a growing small or medium-sized business, which might be, how do I do marketing? Or how do I provide and administer a 401k for my employees? Or how do I hire the best lawyers? As you look back on your entrepreneurial experience, where were the places where you were looking for help, or looking for, boy, I don't know how to do this function, I need to go find a service to do it? Do you recall any that stood out?
I do. Well, let me phrase it like this. I don't know if I necessarily identified, I'm weak here, I need to do this, right? Maybe I'm just not that good of a businessman that I didn't identify that. But what I can tell you is, throughout my career, the best way to learn, the best way to acquire a skill set is, I believe, through kind of a mentoring process. I mean, find those people in your business, even if it's not, you're not a direct report to them, and whether it's a formal or otherwise mentoring process, work with them. I mean, you will learn so much even just observing how they act at lunch, observing how they react to a customer complaint, observing how they deal with employee issues. I think mentoring is a huge, not only a fantastic way to learn, but really underappreciated in kind of today's corporate culture.
So you say you should actively identify your potential mentor and go and approach them. Is that right?
I think it makes sense. Go tell them, hey, I'd like to learn more about your particular story, how you got here, and what I could learn from you. Could we have lunch one day? Start there and see how open they are to it.
Yeah. One of our guests some time ago, Rick Rule, said that key to good mentoring is, one, the mentee must know exactly what they want to get out of it and must work at it, but also the mentor must know what the benefit is for them and what they're going to get out of it too, because there has to be a benefit on both sides. Has that been your experience?
Not in particular. I mean, but it varies for everybody. I mean, everyone's motivated, obviously, in different ways. I could see a lot of people that are willing to be a mentor, not because there's necessarily a benefit to them, but there's a benefit to the company, whether or not it's they realize any kind of accolades for it or any kind of monetary benefit. I think everyone naturally wants to help their business succeed. So I can see a lot of people doing it, even if they don't see a benefit.
Yep. Yeah, just the sharing of experience that you've accumulated. Are your mentors always older than you, or they've just accumulated experience in a different part of the business?
Well, in my experience, they've always been older, but I could definitely see. I see no reason why one could not be younger. Absolutely. I mean, we have some clients that are business owners that are much younger than I am, and I learn from things from them all the time.
Good. Well, I think it's about time to wrap up, Chris. Thank you for today. You've shared a lot of things with us. You've shared your distinctive expertise in financial services. You shared how you select customers and apply Austrian economics for their benefit. And you've talked about the whole entrepreneurial experience, which I think that people learn from. One of our hopes is that we can create an era of entrepreneurship where more people take the self-reliant, start your own business, serve a few customers really well kind of route. Do you find that in your area? Are your customers entrepreneurs typically?
A lot of them are. And if they're not, they're simply, I think, entrepreneurially minded, or because they're open to, you know, I hate the term alternative investments, but they're open to a different viewpoint on the economy, a different viewpoint on the financial markets, a different viewpoint on particular investments that other mainstream advisors would not advise.
Yeah. As you said, the entrepreneurial view of investing. Is there, if anybody wants to find you, where should we send them to? What's your website that they can find you on?
Sure. Our website is windrockwealth.com, just the name of the company, Windrock Wealth. And on there, you know, we certainly have our contact information on there. But even more importantly than that, we have all of our research to date since the inception of the firm. So if you're interested in something, any particular investment theme, if you're interested in a particular take on the economy, we have it all sorted on our research page by theme or by topic, but also whether it's you prefer podcasts, articles, etc.
Good. Well, we'll leave that link on our website for the podcast. And Chris, thank you very much for your time today. We learned a lot.
Thank you, Hunter.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.